A biography is atop many nonfiction bestseller lists this week. It's the story of an American hero who came out of the haunted West and ran circles around his detractors on the East Coast. Very fast circles. Now, at first glance, he didn't strike a heroic profile. He was squat and ungainly, slept too much, and often failed with lame excuses. But he became the most celebrated personality in America during the late 1930s. Not Franklin Roosevelt, Spencer Tracy, Joe DiMaggio, or John Steinbeck, but Seabiscuit, maybe the most game and amazing racehorse in history. Laura Hillenbrand's book is called Seabiscuit, an American Legend. We interviewed Ms. Hillenbrand at her home in Washington, D.C., where she read part of her description of an unsurpassed athlete who didn't look the part.
He had a sad little tail, barely long enough to brush his hocks. His stubby legs were a study in unsound construction, with squarish, asymmetrical baseball glove knees that didn't quite straighten all the way, leaving him in a permanent semi-crouch. Thanks to his unfortunate assembly, his walk was an odd, straddle-legged motion that was often mistaken for lameness. Asked to run, he would drop low over the track and fall into a comical version of what horsemen call an egg-beater gait, making a spastic sideways flailing motion with his left foreleg as he swung it forward, as if he were swatting at flies. His gallop was so disorganized that he had a maddening tendency to whack himself in the front ankle with his own hind hoof. One observer compared his action to a duck waddle.
There were so many things about Seabiscuit that, let me put it this way, are unusual about a horse, beginning with the fact that he actually slept on the ground.
It's rare for horses to sleep for more than about 5 or 10 minutes at a time on the ground. He would keel over and sleep for 8 hours, and it was hard to get him up.
You're struck as you read the story of Seabiscuit. Each and every character had to fight something.
Yeah, each one of them. The owner started out as a bicycle repairman.
This is Charles Howard.
This is Charles Howard, the owner. The trainer, Tom Smith, was a guy who'd ridden in the last of the cattle drives. He was the last cowboy. And the automobile made him obsolete, and he ended up living in a horse stall in Mexico. And the jockey overcame the worst odds of all. Red Pollard was his name. He was abandoned at a racetrack as a boy. He was a bad jockey, and he tried to get by part-time prize fighting, and he was even worse at that. And he was down to 27 cents on the day he found Seabiscuit.
Seabiscuit was sired by Hardtack. He had good lines?
He had good bloodlines to a point. He was a grandson of Man O' War, who was not only the fastest horse who ever lived up to his day, and maybe to this day, but his father was a horse named Hardtack, who had enormous talent, but he was extremely obstreperous. He would terrorize his handlers, and it made him almost worthless as a racehorse. He had lots of speed. He wouldn't show it. He just wanted to fight everyone, and his trainer eventually threw up his hands and retired him, and he ended up in the Army Remount Service.
Charles Howard made a fortune in the car business on the West Coast. How did he wind up buying Seabiscuit?
He owned some not very good horses in California. He was looking for some better horses, and the better horses were in the East. He went to Saratoga Racecourse in New York with his wife, and they were sitting in the grandstand one day when a really ugly horse went by in a post-parade. His wife looked at the horse and offered him a wager of a lemonade that the horse would lose. And he had a hunch, and he took the bet, and the horse won the race. And they shared their lemonade, and they both felt the pull of intuition and bought the horse for $8,000.
And that horse was Seabiscuit.
Yes.
Who had already run more races, I think, than most horses do in their entire racing career.
Yeah, he'd run, I believe, 46 or 47 races by that time. He was only 3 years old. He had been run half to death by his earlier trainer.
Yeah, and run not very well.
Not well at all. He was at the bottom rung of racing most of the time. He couldn't win in cheap claiming races.
What on earth did they see?
Charles Howard said it was heart. He said the horse had a heart as big as all outdoors, and he felt like he saw it in that race. Tom Smith, the trainer, also had seen something in him. When he first saw the horse, he said the horse looked like a cow pony, and Smith had spent his life out on the Mustang ranges, and he admired cow ponies for their toughness. And even though this was so ugly a horse that no one would buy him, and they had been trying to get rid of this horse for a year, they had tried to pawn him off as a polo pony for free, and the person wouldn't take him. But Smith and Howard saw something in this horse.
I'm among other things, fascinated by the fact that Seabiscuit used to share his stall with a whole coterie of other animals.
This was one of the things that trainer Tom Smith did to try to get a turnaround in this horse. Seabiscuit, when he got him, was really a broken down horse. He was 200 pounds underweight. He circled in his stall constantly. He wouldn't sleep. He wouldn't eat. And when he saw a saddle, he broke into a lather. And so Smith thought the first thing he had to do was diffuse the horse. And he tore down the wall between two stalls and housed Seabiscuit with a gigantic yellow cattle roping horse named Pumpkin, who was a real sedative of a horse to be around. Mm-hmm. He also housed him with a stray dog and, believe it or not, a spider monkey named Jojo. And the horses love companionship. It's not new to give racehorses companionship to calm them down, and it just worked a miracle with this horse. The first thing he did was lay down and go to sleep when his friends were around, and he started eating, and he gained back 200 pounds and started thinking about running.
What were some of the methods that Tom Smith used that people thought were really peculiar?
He used a lot of strange things. The big turning point in terms of Seabiscuit as a racehorse was the first workout Tom tried to give him. The horse had been fighting his original trainer all the time as hard as he could. And Tom Smith put an exercise rider up on the horse, sent him out on the track, and Seabiscuit proceeded to fight him every step of the way. He was bucking and rearing and weaving all over the track, and when the guy tried to pull him up, he went faster. When he tried to get him to go, he would slow down. And Smith thought what he was seeing was obstreperousness, because this horse didn't want to be forced to do anything. So he called out to the exercise rider, let him go. And it was a strange thing to tell the exercise rider to do with a horse that's being that badly behaved. And the exercise rider obeyed the instructions, and Seabiscuit ran around and around the track. He tried to jump the infield fence, he weaved all over the place, and the exercise rider did nothing. And the horse figured out he wasn't going to be fought anymore, and he exhausted himself, he stopped. There was nowhere else to go but back to the barn, and Smith stood there with a carrot. And that was the critical lesson. The horse learned that he wasn't going to be forced to do anything anymore, and from that day forward, he was as fast as they come.
I confess, there was a time not so long ago, I wondered if horses knew that they were racing.
They definitely know they're racing,
well,
yes.
Your book convinced me beyond doubt.
They're phenomenally competitive creatures. I don't know that there are creatures on the earth who are more competitive than they are. If you watch even yearlings in their paddocks at the Kentucky horse farms, they race each other all day long, hard. Old stallions will race each other up and down the paddock fences. And frequently you'll see horses lose their riders during races. A rider will fall off coming out of the gate. The horses who are left riderless almost always run to win. They'll run with the pack, they know where they need to be ahead, and they'll try to be ahead at the wire.
At the heart of the story of Seabiscuit is an enormous rivalry that develops between the two greatest horses perhaps of all time.
At least two of the greatest. Yeah. It was a wonderful coincidence that two of the greatest, really the most elite horses ever, came along at the same time. And War Admiral was the rival's name, and he was Seabiscuit's polar opposite. He was extraordinarily beautiful. He was a winner right from the start. And he was from New York, and he was essentially the representative of the Eastern racing establishment. California, where Seabiscuit came from, was the upstart racing state. It was considered the minor leagues. And the two horses were such opposites, including in disposition. War Admiral was a very difficult animal, very high-strung. Seabiscuit, once Tom Smith got his hands on him, was a wonderful, delightful animal to be around, very sweet, like a big dog. And they developed just a fevered rivalry, and the whole country was divided over their allegiances. And for 2 years, they tried to put together a match race, and they finally did in 1938, and it drew 40 million radio listeners.
Ladies and gentlemen, I found it impossible to get through this enormous throng at Pimlico today, the first time that I've ever failed to do that from the paddock. And so I'm down here in the winner's circle, perched high up on a fence.
Now, let's set this up. They were starting in a way that I've never seen in a horse race.
This was the old antiquated way of starting horse races, yeah. War Admiral was a hellion at the starting gate. He was a very difficult horse to break. And his owner insisted that it be done with a walk-up, which is something he was quite experienced at. He used to really raise hell every time they tried to load him into a starting gate. And eventually they would give up and load him, or not load him, let him walk up to the start on the outside. So he was experienced at this kind of start. Seabiscuit had never done it before. But Tom Smith, on Red Pollard's advice, Red Pollard is at this time hospitalized from a racing injury, began training the horse in an unusual way, using an alarm clock to train the horse to break fast. Everybody on Earth thought that War Admiral would outbreak Seabiscuit. He was considered to be the greatest breaker of all time, and they were in for a surprise.
And they're off, and this is a go! And Georgie Wolf is at the whip on Seabiscuit to keep him up, and they're coming to me head and head. War Admiral on the inside. Wolf is driving Seabiscuit, and Seabiscuit is outrunning him. Seabiscuit is coming to
just what we hoped we'd get. They're head and head, and both jockeys driving. It's the best horse from here in. They've got 200 yards to come. It's horse against horse. Both of them driving. Seabiscuit leads by a length. Now Seabiscuit by a length and a half. Wolf has put away his whip. Seabiscuit by three. Seabiscuit by three. Seabiscuit is the winner by four lengths. And you never saw such a wild crowd. Seabiscuit, the winner by four lengths.
A huge victory.
As good as it gets.
I mean, just breathless.
It brings tears to my eyes every time I hear it, and I've heard it 100 times now.
Yeah. A lot of great horses would be retired after that. He was older than most race horses anyway, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was about to turn six when he won this, and that's getting near the end of racehorses' careers.
But they decided that he still had a racing career ahead of him.
War Admiral was always kind of a sidelight. They wanted that Santa Anita handicap, and Seabiscuit had lost it twice by a nose in extraordinarily difficult circumstances. And they entered him for 1939. He lost it by a nose in 37 and 38 and was training like a tiger for it in 1939 when he was injured in his prep race. Not long beforehand, Red Pollard had suffered his own leg injury. He had been in the hospital during the match race because he had been rammed into the corner of a barn by a horse at 30 miles an hour and had virtually torn off his lower leg. So horse and jockey retreated to Howard's farm together, and they recuperated together. They would walk the fields, both of them limping, at first Red on his crutches. Month after month, eventually Red got in the saddle, and he was so diminished by his injury, his weight dropped to 86 pounds. He couldn't hold the horse himself, so Howard would get on a pony and lead them around. And month after month, they went from walking to trotting to cantering, and the horse got sound again. And Red didn't, but they wanted that Santa Anita handicap, and Red wanted to come back with him.
Seabiscuit won the Santa Anita handicap, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Now, unlike, say, the match race against War Admiral, there are lots of other horses on the field, and they seemed to block him for a while. There was a real chance that he wouldn't be able to get through.
Yes, and Red Pollard came into that race. His calf muscle had never grown back from his broken leg. He had the bones strapped together with a metal brace. He was that decrepit coming into this race, and he had been told over and over again, one bump, one twist, and you'll never walk again. But Red wanted to ride this race, but he was terrified that the horse would be bumped in the race, and he was bumped. He was bumped into a pocket, and he couldn't get out, and this is as they're coming to the top of the stretch, and he had an armful of horse underneath him and couldn't get out and started praying aloud. The other jockeys could hear him, and for one brief moment, two horses in front of him parted. It was just a very narrow hole ahead of them, and Red had to decide whether he was willing to risk his leg to go through this hole, and he leaned forward in the saddle and shouted, "Now, Pop."
That's what he called Seabiscuit, right? Because he was so old, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Now Pop, and Pop came through.
Pop came through.
Yeah. This has not been an easy book for you to get accomplished.
No, it hasn't. I have chronic fatigue syndrome, and for me that is manifested in quite severe exhaustion and chronic vertigo, which ironically makes reading and writing very difficult. So it was a difficult thing for me to do. I put myself through a lot of punishment to do it because the more I read and write, the worse my vertigo is. And there are a few symptoms in the world that are worse than chronic severe dizziness. But on the other hand, this is the kind of story that you want to escape into when you're in a physical condition like mine. And it was a wonderful thing to wake up in the morning and be able to step out of this broken body of mine and into this world, into 1938, and into the lives of these vigorous individuals.
I was touched by your account of what Charles Howard did when Seabiscuit died in 1947. I mean, this was a horse for whom the American public gladly would have built a mausoleum. But that's not what happened.
It's not what happened. And it's interesting because Howard was the one who did it. Because Howard was a man who had raised heaven and earth to make this horse famous. He had done everything he possibly could. But when the horse died, he made his last gesture to him, a private one, which was he didn't build a gravestone. He didn't put any kind of marker on the horse's grave. Simply, he buried him out on his ranch and put an oak sapling over it and told only his sons where the oak sapling was and told no one else.
If this doesn't sound too strange, and I'm not even going to apologize if it does come to think of it, did you learn something from Seabiscuit?
I learned from him as well as from these people. They were inspiring to me in terms of pulling themselves up out of the hole. I mean, these guys, there are a lot of bumps in this journey to the top for these people. And the main theme that runs through this story and through each of these very different lives that I'm talking about is overwhelming hardship and the struggle of will to overcome it. And this is a main theme in my life because of my health. And they were a daily lesson to me in how to get up with dignity and go on with your life when devastating things happen to you. And I look at all of them as models for my own life.
Including the horse?
Including the horse.
Laura Hillenbrand, author of Seabiscuit, an American Legend,